Now today we continue our journey within organizations and we look at the issue of decision rights. Now this is a copy of one of the slides from the previous lecture, Introduction to Organizations. I quite like this physical analogy with a three-legged stool. So a stool, in order to be stable, has to have three legs. And organizations to exist and be stable, in order not to disintegrate, have to have three foundations which have to talk to each other and have to be in proportion with each other, like the three equal and equally spaced legs of a stool. So organizations are based on decision rights, rewards practices, and permeating a complex arrangement of decision rights and reward practices is evaluation. So performance evaluation, which is the topic that we will spend two lectures of this course discussing, not now, but in a few weeks' time, is a key element in keeping organizations alive, because that's how various agents learn about each other and that's how principals learn about the outcomes of the agents' actions on which they make contracts with the agents. But today's lecture is about decision rights, so let's focus on the decision rights. What are the decision rights? Well, we will learn about the different types of decision rights, the different elements of decision rights. For now, let me just give you a gentle introduction to the issue. Now, so let's get back to the very beginning of the course when we were talking about what is it that organizations are doing, right? So so organizations unite agents, different agents, which have different interests, and these interests can sometimes be conflicting. So the conflict of interests between different agents creates a variety of very interesting situations that need to be managed. Right, so organizations are not only about willing and altruistic cooperation between different idealistic souls that want to maximize the common good. Organizations do contribute to the common good, but this contribution requires management, the conflict of interest between different agents. And decision rights is the key ingredient into the management of conflict, into the effective management of the conflict of interest between different agents, between agents being different parts of an organization. And the decision rights, another sort of almost synonym for decision rights, is the term that you may have come across, the term of organizational architecture. So who does what within an organization, and how much power different parts of an organization have over the actions that they are entitled, to take, that they are entrusted with. Now, here's an example from the textbook, from the Brickley Smith Timmerman textbook, which is the background textbook for this part of the course. Let me just briefly go through it, leaving much of it to your study in the textbook. So the case that the textbook considered was the case of the Honda Motor Company. Everybody knows Honda. And the firm has evolved over the, you know, over the seven decades of its existence. It has evolved from being very centralized to very decentralized, and then it evolved or revolved back to a fairly centralized organization. So what do we mean by centralized? A centralized organization is an organization in which decision rights, decision powers, are concentrated in the hands of the relatively few agents, right? So this is an organizational architecture in which the stool has few legs, but these legs are really powerful and long and big and very important. Now, then later on, it evolved to become a decentralized organization. What does it mean? It means that some of the decision powers, some of the prerogatives that different agents had within organizations were delegated down to the lower levels of hierarchy. Then, of course, it was very democratic and stuff, but the firm has faced inefficiencies, because people who were entrusted with fairly large decision powers, there were relatively many people, different departments had their different agendas, and they couldn't agree on just about anything. So an important strategic decisions which had to be made on time were made with a delay, costing Honda part of its competitive advantage on the market. Now, in order to try and recap its market position, a lot of decision power, which had previously been delegated to the lower hierarchical level, was taken and returned to the higher levels of hierarchy, to the top management level. And that's called re-centralization. So, because Honda missed important market changes, missed important opportunities to react to market changes because of the low speed with which decisions involving various many decision makers with large decision making powers, because these decisions took a long time to make, the firm could not react very quickly to the changes on the market in order to increase the speed of reaction, in order to improve the coordination within the firm. Part of the decision powers previously delegated to lower hierarchical levels were returned back to the top. So it's centralization, decentralization, and then back to centralization. Now these changes, and Honda is not the only firm that has gone through the evolution characterized by changes in the distribution of decision rights, decision powers within an organization. These changes reflect the fact, well, at least a theory, a powerful theory, which is supported by a number of facts, that there exists an optimal configuration of decision rights that depends on market forces. And we will look at the market forces that shape optimal configuration of decision rights. Here is the plan of today's lecture. We will talk about what decision rights are and the various classifications of decision rights, what exactly we mean by decision rights. And basically the classifications of decision rights that we will study today are two. One is vertical allocation of decision rights, when you classify decision rights in terms of higher or lower levels of centralization. That's the Honda story. Then we will study the horizontal allocation of decision rights. Now, what is horizontal allocation of decision rights? It's not about hierarchy. It's not about top management delegating some decision-making powers to lower levels of hierarchy. It's within a certain hierarchy level. Do you give decision-making powers to particular individuals and make them responsible individually for the consequences of their actions? Or do you allocate decision-making powers to groups of individuals or teams? Thus, you can leverage on the collective experience of team members, which should hopefully contribute to the quality of decision-making, but the consequences and costs of allocating decision powers to teams is various problems that are mentioned in the literature, of which we will consider two: the free rider problem that I think we touched upon when we discussed games, and also the problem of agenda setting, which we haven't discussed yet. We will complete today's lecture by reflecting on the difference between decision management and decision control. The main takeaway point there is that given the decision rights allocation, an optimal decision rights allocation, that is, should always ensure that there are at least two agents involved in a given decision. One agent implements the decision, the other agent, hopefully independent, preferably an independent agent, controls the implementation of the decision. So the separation of decision management and decision control will be the last topic that we will study today. Now, so let's look at the basics of organizations and try to derive the notion of decision rights from there. So what organizations do, being collective of individuals united for the pursuit of a common goal, going back to the previous definition? Organizations produce some outputs, products, services that are sold on the market. They use inputs to produce these outputs. There is a production function, production process. Now, but the production process from an organizational point of view consists of different, potentially very many, stages called tasks. So in the production of output, various inputs are combined, the combining of these inputs and ensuring that the required amount of output is produced consists of several tasks. Now, these tasks are carried out by different agents within an organization, different departments or different individuals. And these different agents within an organization are entrusted with a certain configuration of decision rights. And the configuration of decision rights determines what is in organizational economics understood as a job, right? Well, there's a common understanding of what a job is. It's a certain activity that you have to do in order to get a certain amount of pay. My job is to teach organizational economics. But from the organizational point of view, a job is a combination of the tasks that a certain agent is entrusted with, plus superimposed on this combination is a combination of a certain decision rights that this individual has over the tasks that he or she is supposed to do. Let me give you a few examples to understand the difference between tasks and decision rights and how the tasks and decision rights together create the job, the notion of the job. Now, let's use some graphs to get, you know, to get less abstract, more concrete understanding. Consider four jobs within an organization. So, job number one is some data entry operative, you know, someone who processes incoming invoices or outgoing invoices, some administrative assistant within an organization, referred to as typist, because they type. Now, job number two is a secretary. It's also an administrative employee, but with a wider range of tasks. So if you compare job number one with job number two, you will see that they differ in terms of the range of the number of tasks that are entrusted to the people that take these jobs, right? So they are different in terms of the range of tasks. A secretary does more wider range of tasks than a data entry specialist, right? A secretary not only enters some data, a secretary also arranges travel, does some controlling functions, organizes diaries of the bosses, makes sure meetings take place, etc. So there's more tasks that the secretary does. But what about decision-making power? What about the decision rights? What about the things that these people can or cannot do? It turns out that they have approximately the same amount of decision rights, the same amount of decision-making authority, which is, in their case, rather little, right? The secretary doesn't have a lot of decision-making power, has some, right? The secretary can make some choices within the secretary's job, but this range or this amount of decision-making power is severely restricted, and the typist has almost no decision-making power. Now, let's move on to job number three in this graph. This is a sales agent. This organization produces and sells something. So he's, say, for example, what is its fancy job title? Key account manager, right? It's a person or a department that organizes sales of a particular product on a particular market, right? Now, the sales person doesn't do a wide range of tasks because they typically concentrate on a particular product and particular market, right? But they have a lot of decision-making authority within the narrow range of tasks that they are entitled to. So, in particular, they can negotiate within some boundaries. Of course, the decision-making authority is not infinite, but within a certain boundaries, they can, for instance, negotiate the price, the quantity, the logistics, the timing of deliveries, and other operational and other aspects of their operations. But so even though they have a lot of decision-making authority, their range of tasks is limited. Now, the job number four is, well, think about it as it's for example. You can think of other jobs that fit this description. For example, the head of sales. Now, the head of sales has a lot of decision-making authority, not at least as much as individual sales departments under their management. But the difference, the more interesting difference between the sales department and the head of sales is that the head of sales has a broader range of tasks because the head of sales oversees the different markets and different products that are dealt with individually by the individual and dedicated sales agents, departments, or management. So each job has two dimensions. One dimension is decision-making authority. Some jobs have really little decision-making authority. Other jobs have a lot of decision-making authority. This will be the topic of today's lecture, how much decision-making authority different jobs have and should optimally have. Now, next time we'll be looking at the range of tasks. So jobs also differ along the second dimension, which is the range of tasks. Some jobs have really few tasks. Other jobs have really many tasks. Now, is this choice random, or is this choice strategic? Is this choice driven by some profit-maximizing considerations? Of course, it is strategic. It is driven by profit-maximizing considerations. We will learn more about why some jobs have few tasks and others have many tasks next week. So today, let's look at the notion of decision rights or decision-making authority. Now, what are decision rights? Decision rights are the rights to make decisions. It's tautology, right? So this is the right to make decisions. But what does it involve? What does the right to make decisions involve? Now, it turns out that there are several components to decision-making process. And a given agent can have different amounts of decision-making authority over these five components of the decision-making process. So, initiation, searching for information, ratification, implementation, and monitoring. So, if you want to make a decision, right, if you want to do something within an organization, you have to initiate, you have to propose. Right, you have to think, I think I should do it, and a certain decision, a certain action needs to be proposed. And you may or may not have the authority, you may or may not have the decision power to initiate a certain proposal. Right? So, for example, today I was attending a committee that dealt with hiring a new macroeconomics professor at the University of Constance. So we need a new macroeconomics professor. As a department of economics at the University of Constance, collectively, we have the decision-making authority to initiate the search for a suitable candidate for the position of macroeconomics professor, which will become vacant soon, right? So me individually, I don't have this decision-making power. I may think it would be nice to have five macroeconomics professors, but I cannot propose that the University of Constance should advertise five macroeconomic professors. So that's an example. Let's stick with this example. Now, the next component of decision-making process is searching for information, searching for the best way to implement the initiative that has been proposed before, right? So we've agreed collectively that we need a macroeconomics professor. Now we search for information for the best way to implement it. What is the best way to implement it? The best way to implement it is to find the best person that will fit the description of a professor of macroeconomics. So we put an advert. That's a technical task, which we may or may not do. It's not very strategic. Strategic element here in the searching for information is searching for the person who we think will be the best professor of macroeconomics at the University of Constance. We have a lot of applicants. We rank them in terms of their attractiveness, in terms of their professional qualifications, professional attractiveness, and we make the decision. We identify the top five people who we think are the top five best professors of macroeconomics among those who have applied. So this is the searching for information. Now, again, different agents within an organization may have different amounts of decision-making power when it comes to searching for information. The Department of Economics has the decision-making power to review CVs and applications and write reports, the Gutachten, rank the applicants in terms of how good we think they are. Now, another department, let's say Department of Physics at the University of Konstanz, does not have a decision-making power to search for information to identify the best macro professor. Why? Is this a coincidence or is this organizational architectural design? It's not a coincidence. Why don't they have the power to search for information? Who is the best macroeconomics professor? Well, obviously, because they don't really have enough information to decide who is the best macro professor, because what they do is physics, right? So the next component in the decision-making process is ratification. So when an initiative has been put forward, the best way to, or seemingly the best way, seemingly for the agents who were empowered with this task, the best way to implement this initiative has been found, and then it needs to be ratified. What is ratification? It's reviewing the initiative itself and the proposed way of implementing it. So basically saying, oh yeah, I like your idea, and the people who you've selected, yeah, they are your selection makes sense. You know, you've selected these people not because they're friends of yours or relative of yours, but because they really are good professors, they've published a lot and students are happy with them. So that's the ratification. Now, ratification may result in an agreement to the decision as it has been proposed at the previous stages, in which case we get a rubber stamp from the Senate and so we are welcome to make official offers to the number one on our professors list, or in some cases it may be declined as a result of the ratification process. It may be declined. The Senate or the rector or the other agents within the University of Konstanz who are empowered with the decision-making power to ratify may say, no, sorry, we don't agree with your selection. We think there are better candidates who you have missed. Please, can you go and reconsider your selection? Or they may say, you know what, yeah, we agree with your ranking, but none of the people who you have been able to find are good enough for this position, so we have to re-advertise. Or maybe we should even stop the recruitment process. Yeah. So the power to make this decision, critically, the power to make the decision to ratify should rest with agents different from the agents who made the initiation and searching for information decisions, right? Why is this the case? This has to do with the necessity to separate decision management from decision control, the topic that we will reconsider towards the end of the lecture. It's very important to separate decision management from decision control in order to avoid moral hazard and abuse of decision-making authority. Now, look here. Suppose we, the Department of Economics at the University of Konstanz, have equal amount of decision rights over searching for information and ratification. Then the decision that we will make will be obviously in our favor, because we will just agree to the decision we ourselves have previously made. Right? You see my point? So if I want to employ my friend, who is not really a very good macro professor, but a really nice guy, I really like to play bowling with him. So I initiate, I search, and of course he will be number one on my list. And if I have the power to ratify this decision, I will rubber stamp and hire him. Now, will it be good for the organization? No. In order to avoid this situation, there are different agents within an organization who are empowered with searching for information and ratification. And in order to even further strengthen the ratification procedure, some external agents are asked, some external professors are asked to write reports agreeing or disagreeing with the selection procedure as we have implemented it in the Department of Economics. Now, the decision has been initiated. The best way to implement this decision has been found. This way of implementing decision has been agreed by the agent who ratifies the decision. Now it's the time to implement the decision. So we've agreed everybody has agreed that, you know, Mr. X is the best candidate for the position of macroeconomics professor. We make an offer to Mr. X. What will be in this offer? Lots of details, but the most important detail will be the salary. Okay? So everybody agrees that this person is the best candidate for macro position. We've been ratified and everything. Now it's the time to implement. How much authority, how much decision-making power we have over the implementation and the various aspects of the implementation? We do have a lot of decision-making power over some aspects of implementation. For example, we do have a lot of decision-making power over exactly which courses this person is supposed to teach, which office they have to occupy, how much research money they can get to support the research activities. We have relatively little decision-making power when it comes to the aspect of implementation that has to do with wages. In fact, we have almost zero decision-making power there. The rector in the University of Constance and the chancellor, they have a lot more decision-making power when it comes to implementing the monetary part, the salary part of the decision that we have previously initiated, searched for the best ways to accomplish, and our idea has been ratified. So you see, the various aspects of decision-making power are spread between different agents within an organization. They can be spread more, or they can be concentrated. When the decision-making powers are concentrated, when, for instance, the department can do initiation, searching, ratification, implementation, and everything, this is called centralized decision-making system. This is what Honda looked like when, you know, a long time ago. Now, if you spread decision-making power across more agents within an organization, then it's called decentralization, right? So now, once it has been implemented, the last stage of the decision-making process is monitoring. So we have hired person, we have decided, or somebody has decided how much wage to offer to that person. That person has accepted, so everything's good. The person is giving a lecture, and then there is monitoring. Control over how the ratified decision was in fact implemented, what results it brought, and why. So, typically, in the majority of employment contract, there is a term called probatite. Have you heard about it? So why is it there? Right? Why is it there? This is there to monitor the performance of the person who has been decided to be hired. Right? Now, so let's look at the decision rights allocation. So I mentioned the centralized decision-making systems and decentralized decision-making system. It's in fact a spectrum. It's just like the extent of vertical integration between different firms that we studied in the last lecture. It's a spectrum. You can have different degree of decision rights centralization versus decentralization. To illustrate, let's consider an example of a car dealership. You know, so here's a car dealership. It's got the central office somewhere in Munich, right? For example, and it has local branches: one in Constance, one in Frankfurt, one in Stuttgart, one in wherever. And each of the branches has the local manager, and reporting to this local manager are the individual sales agents that meet and greet you when you enter the dealership and want to choose a car for yourself. Now, so the question that we want to present with this example is the question related to vertical decision rights allocation, namely, how centralized or decentralized is it optimal to for this organization, for this car dealership to be, right? Which decisions and which stages of the decision-making process should be centralized, and which decisions and stages in the decision-making process should be decentralized? Centralized means allocated to particular department or individual to a large extent. Decentralized means spread across the various departments and individuals. And specifically, to make it easy and tractable, we will focus on one particular very important aspect of decision making, namely the price. So, and the question is, who decides and to what extent, who decides about the price? Now, there is a list price of a car that you see in all these booklets and prospects. Don't believe your eyes. The actual price of a car may, and in most cases will be, different from the list price. Why? Specifications, the showroom models versus the models that have to be assembled specially for you, trade-in decisions, you know, because many people would like to trade in their existing cars for new ones, and the price at which you trade in your car is decided by and large, not completely, but very largely by the dealership that, by the local office in which you, with whom you're talking, right? So, the price of the car is basically the difference between the list price and the trade-in price. Who decides and to what extent who decides about the price of the car? Now, what are the options? One option, one extreme case is for the central office of this dealership to decide about the price of each car up to every euro, up to the euro, right? So there can be, in principle, there can be very strict guidelines regarding the price of the new car and the trade-in prices. In order to fully centralize everything, you can just say, no, we don't accept, we don't do trade-ins. So this is one situation in which the decision-making regarding prices is very, very centralized. Now, the other extreme is to allow the local managers, is to allow the local sales team the complete power over setting the price at which the customers could have this car. Now, of course, obviously, none of these two extremes are observed in practice, right? What you do observe in practice is something in the middle. So this is the full centralization, when all decisions are made centrally, the degree of decentralization is zero, and therefore all prices are determined completely by the central office. This is the full decentralization, when all prices are completely determined by the local offices. Now, this is somewhere in the mid-range. This is the optimal degree of decentralization. This is the range of discounts that local offices, local sales teams can discretionally make in each individual case to the customers who are interested in buying cars. And that's exactly how many car dealerships operate. Each sales manager has a certain budget, it's typically a couple of thousand euros, that is completely within his or her discretion to offer as a discount to the customer who they think would be more likely to accept the offer if this discount had been given to them. You know, these sales managers, they're very, very intelligent people, and they're very good psychologists. They can see where the money is. So if they think that you like the car so much that you are going to buy it, they will not offer you a discount. But if they see that you are hesitating, they will estimate how much they should offer you in order to make the deal sweeter, sweet enough for you to accept. In order to do that, they need to have a certain amount of decision-making power. And this amount of decision-making power is provided to them by the design of by the organizational architecture, by the organizational design that is implemented in the firm. You understand my story? Can you relate to it somehow? Or do you have any questions, clarifications? No? Makes sense, right? So in this example, decision-making authority is not complete, but it's not zero. It's somewhere in between. Okay? So why do we observe, and that's not only specific to car dealerships, you can think of many, many other examples like this, right? So I can choose which hotel to stay during my next business trip, okay? So I do have some decision-making power over the range of the price of hotels that I can choose, okay? But there are some guidelines that specify the maximum price of the hotel in which I can stay, and I can't go beyond these guidelines. If I do, then I will have to pay the rest myself. Okay, so I am free to live in any hotel between 0 and, I don't know, 500 euros per night. Whatever I like. I don't have to explain my choice. Now, when I'm on a business trip, I can take public transport or I can take a taxi. Okay, the public transport costs next to 0, taxi costs a lot of money. Obviously, I take taxi because it's more convenient. And I can take taxi, but surely a private jet or a chauffeur-driven limousine would be even better. Can I take it? No, because this is too much decentralization. This is too much decision-making power delegated from the central office to the little guys like myself. Okay? There's an optimal degree of decentralization. Now, why is there an optimal degree of decentralization? Why is it not always full centralization of decision-making power or full decentralization of decision-making power? The reason is that both centralization and decentralization have advantages and disadvantages. And the optimal degree of decentralization is shaped by the profit-maximizing trade-off between the advantages and disadvantages of decentralization. So let's go through the advantages and disadvantages of decentralization more systematically. So let's start with the advantages of decentralization. Now, the key advantage is that decentralized decision-making allows a better use of local knowledge, right? So to go back to the example of a car salesperson, yeah, if this car salesperson had no power, had no decision making power over the price, then only the people who would really, really love to buy the car at the list price would end up buying the car. Would firm maximize its profits then? I don't think so, because even if they do give you a discount, they will end up making profit from you. Otherwise, they won't do it themselves. So there is a range of prices at which the deals are still profitable. And if you can't offer this range of price, you are denying yourself the possibility to make deals which are still profitable. Maybe not as profitable as you hope, but still have a non-zero profit. Now, if you want to make as many deals as possible and maximize your profit, you have to allow some discretion to the agents who make the sale on your behalf. If you don't want to do that, then you have to go and speak to every individual customer and agree on the price with them and make this decision yourself. But because you don't have the time or you don't have the knowledge required to make these decisions, you have to delegate some of the decision-making power in order to take advantage of the higher amount of deals and larger profits that can be made. So one key advantage of decentralization is the local knowledge that can be better used. Now, a related advantage of decentralization is the saving on communication costs and time costs that centralized decision-making requires. If you want to centralize all decision makers, if you want to be the big boss and ratify and control every aspect of the decision that is being made within your organization, you have to read hundreds of pages every day, you have to speak to hundreds if not thousands of people every day, you have to understand tens of thousands of deals, contracts, agreements, arrangements, taxes, etc., which is impossible. So there are huge communication and time and effort costs of making decisions if decision making is centralized. So if you want to save on these costs, if you want to make the functioning of your organization consistent with the physical limitations, physical and cognitive limitations of yourselves, you have to delegate some of the decision making power to other people. And it saves in particular the senior management time, which can be used for more productive activities, like for instance developing and monitoring the business strategy to better face the next challenge on the market. And also, the last but not least advantage of decentralization is that if there is enough decentralization in decision-making power, there are plentiful opportunities for training and motivation for local managers. So, going back to the car dealership example, if everything is centralized, if cars are sold only at the list price, no negotiation possible, the opportunities for car sales managers to make sales and to learn from making sales are quite limited because, for instance, they don't have the power to experiment. They don't have the power to, you know, try different ways of selling things to different customers using discounts as one potential stimulus. Of course, you can still learn. You can still learn. You can try to become such an excellent salesperson that people will simply not notice the price. They will just want to buy this for whatever price because you're so excellent. But I think if you have a little bit of discretionary budget to support your experimentation and your excellent salesmanship, then both training opportunities and motivation for you to perform on your job can be made all that much stronger. By motivation, we mean incentives, which will be the topic of, I think, the lecture that comes after next week. So there are a lot of advantages of decentralizations, and that's why a lot of decision-making power is, in fact, decentralized, that is, delegated to the lower-level departments within the firm. Right? So the rectorate could potentially have been in charge of hiring each and every professor, okay, each and every employee at the university. They could. And on paper, they are. But they delegate a lot of decision-making power, initiation, searching for the best way, implementation to some extent, and monitoring to limited extent. They delegate to the lower levels. Why? Because there are advantages to be enjoyed from delegation of the decision-making power. Now, why is not all decision-making power delegated completely? Because there are disadvantages. You know, you can delegate too much power. And there are two big disadvantages that the literature is talking about. The first one, it goes under the heading incentive problems and abuse of authority. What does it mean? What is incentive problems and abuse of authority? Well, let's get back to this example that I gave you when I was illustrating the decision-making process. So we are hiring a macroeconomics professor. We think we should have one, so we have the decision-making power to initiate. We advertise the vacancy and we make the short list and the top list of candidates that we think are the best. If we also ratify our shortlist, then there's a problem because we can very easily hire, you know, not the best macro professors, but the guys we like to play bowling with. And we're going to have a very great time playing bowling instead of doing research in our department. Right? So in order to, this is clearly an incentive problem. And this incentive problem reveals the conflict of interest between the different agents within the same organization. Organizations want to optimize their efficiency. They want to optimize their output. They want to maximize their profit. The agents who work in organizations do not necessarily want to optimize efficiency. The agents who work in an organization want to have a comfortable life. And playing bowling with your colleagues during work time, I think, is great for having a comfortable life. Now, you see, because of this conflict of interest, there is an incentive problem, and we can actually abuse our decision-making authority by making the choice which is blatantly suboptimal as far as the organization is concerned. So, in order to prevent agents from abusing their decision-making power, and in order to prevent too much conflict of interest within an organization, typically, the decision-making power is not completely decentralized. Some ratification and monitoring powers are kept centrally in order to provide a system of checks and balances to control the agents within a certain range of decisions that they are allowed to make. So that's the big problem with decentralization. If you decentralize, people will start abusing the new powers that you're giving to them. So we have to define the terms more precisely. We have to define advantages and disadvantages for whom, right? Sure, yes. Now, by here, we mean advantages and disadvantages for the organization as a whole, right? So it's basically what is good and what is bad for the profits in the end. Right? So, of course, more decentralization is an advantage for the agents who receive this. But it's a disadvantage for the organization, and that's why it's here. Is it clear? Okay. Now, the second major disadvantage of too much decentralization is the so-called coordination problems. Now, in the game theory tutorial, I think it was, you can see, I think you went through the so-called the signaling game, you know, right, left, up, down. We have this. I think in the lecture we have this. So this is an example of a coordination game which has two equilibria, and if you're lucky enough to hit the right button and the other guy hits the right button as well, then you are in an equilibrium in which you're both very well. Unfortunately, the equilibria is more than one. There is more than one way of doing things, and you have to coordinate on the way of doing things that is best for you both. Consider, not really an example for management, but to make things extremely clear, consider driving. You know, consider driving. Is it better to drive on the right side of the road or the left side of the road? There are two ways of driving on the road that will keep you alive. The question is, suppose you come from Mars and you don't know if it's England. Suppose it's really dark at night and you really don't know where you are, right? So you come to England and you don't realize that you have to keep left. You keep right because you like it. And then goes bump and you're in heaven. Right, so you have to keep left in England, you have to keep right in Germany, but more importantly, you have to know where to keep right and where to keep left. And that requires coordination. That requires being aware of what the other partner in the game is doing. Okay, so another example, suppose you want to meet up with a friend and you don't have telephone numbers. So you agreed to meet up somewhere in the city center. And you go to the city center and you think, where am I likely to find this friend? There are two cafes in the city center, the blue cafe and the red cafe. You know that your friend likes the blue cafe. And you like the red cafe. And you also know that your friend knows that you like the red cafe. And you know that your friend knows that you know that your friend knows that you know that your friend knows ad nauseum that you like the red cafe and he likes the blue cafe. Which cafe will he go to? The right answer is, there is no right answer. There are two equilibria in this game. Either you should all come to the red cafe or you should all come to the blue cafe. It doesn't matter which cafe you go to. As long as you're both in the same cafe, you will meet. But if you're in a separate cafes, you will not meet, and you will have wasted what could have been a good evening, right? So this is a typical coordination problem. And to solve the coordination problem, you need to provide agents with information. And the provision of information in organizations is a very, very complicated task. Right? So if you have a lot of decentralization, if the degree of decentralization is very, very high, right, then different agents will have lots of decision-making power, and in exercising their decision-making power, they will fail to coordinate their actions with one another. An example with car dealership. Okay. So suppose that you've given really a lot of decision-making power. Suppose you've given the powers to the sales agent to offer discounts of up to, I don't know, 20% of the list price, which is very high. Suppose, just for the sake of argument, up to 20%. Okay. So suppose you are a rich person and you really like the car you want to buy. So you would have bought it even without the discount. And you don't know that the decision that the agents have so much decision-making power. So you enter the dealership, you see this Aston Martin, and you say, "Oh, I'm loving it. I'm buying it for whatever cash it costs." Okay. So you get in. You are served by a sales agent. The sales agent is not offering you any deal because he sees that, you know, you're very enthusiastic about buying this car. But then your partner is telling you, "Look, Nick, be reasonable. You know, let's shop around. Let's see, maybe you could find a similar car for a lower price, you know." And you go to another dealership within the same network, and you see exactly the same Aston Martin, but then the sales agent there is more entrepreneurial. And he can be, because he can give you a discount of up to 20%. And he says, "You know, I can give you a discount of 5,000 euros on this car if you buy it. And you say, oh, wow, excellent, I will buy the car here. But then your partner says, no, no, you know what, let's shop around. You go back to this to that dealership which you were in and say, oh, you know what, I saw an identical car in another dealership which is 5,000 euros cheaper than what you're offering me. And that sales agent says, oh, you can have it 10,000 euros cheaper. Because it's still profitable, they can still make a profit, right? They are within their decision-making power. You say, ah, wait a moment. So you go back to that dealership and say, you know, your friend from across the street is offering 10,000 euros. Let's see how much you're going to offer to me. You get the idea. So we can, too much decentralization can instigate a situation which is not unlike Bertrand competition in price, which we studied before in the lecture, right? Now, is it good for firms or not? It obviously is not good for firms because we know that the equilibrium behavior in Bertrand competition, especially when the goods are pure substitutes, is to offer the price equal to the marginal cost and have a profit equal to zero, right? So, and why is this happening? Because the different agents have so much decision-making power and they just don't coordinate with one another, right? It would take a simple phone call saying, you see this guy in a black hat who is just left my office? He really wants to buy that Aston Martin, but please don't offer him a price, don't offer him a discount of more than 10,000 euros because I know that he's filthy rich and he will buy it even without a discount. You say, oh yeah, yeah, sure, yeah, you've got it. But then you offer him a discount of 10,500 euros because you want to make a bonus for yourself. You don't care about that other guy. It's exactly the same as the Bertrand competition in real firms, no? So that's what's going to happen to you. And it's a big disadvantage for the firm. It's an advantage for you because you will get your bonus. You will find it easier to sell the car and your bonus depends on the number of cars that you sell. But it's not very good for the organization. And in order to avoid coordination problems and in order to avoid incentive problems coming from too much decentralization, firms do not decentralize too much. In fact, there exists an optimal degree of decentralization. This is a level of decentralization. Think about it as a maximum percentage of discount that you can give for a car, which maximizes the difference between the benefits of decentralization in terms of local knowledge, communications, etc., etc., the difference between these benefits and the costs of decentralization. When decentralization is very low, there is more benefits to enjoy than it costs, so you have to decentralize to increase the profit. But when decentralization is too high, the benefits from it are lower than the costs, okay? So you should not decentralize, you should re-centralize. Yeah? So there exists an optimal degree of decentralization. Now, that's not the end of the story, because the optimal degree of decentralization is not something that is written in the stone and will remain the same forever and ever. In fact, the optimal degree of decentralization is affected by a lot of things that evolve, by a lot of things that change in the market. So that's why Honda went from centralization to decentralization and then it went back to recentralization. So if you're operating in a volatile environment, if the technology, market environment, laws, taxes, politics change a lot of times and you have to quickly react to things, right? Tomorrow they're going to forbid diesel-driven cars in big cities. You have to react today in order to save the market. You have to decentralize, you have to give decision-making power to the agents who have better local information and who can more quickly react to the change in circumstances. Because it may be too late before you get your initiative ratified and approved by the higher up levels in the firm. The opportunity may be missed. Now, the more diverse business portfolio you operate, the more reliant you have to be on the local knowledge of the different agents that work for you. Therefore, you should decentralize more. All right? The more vertically integrated your firm is, you know what vertical integration is. You know, you're vertically integrated if you own suppliers or retailers of your product, if you have big ownership packages in the firms that supply you, up and down the supply chain. That's from the previous lecture. So if the degree of vertical integration is very high, Right? You have to you tend to decentralize more. Why do you tend to decentralize more? It's not because of the variability and changeability in the market, but because when you have higher degree of vertical integration, you are in a better position to control the decision taken within different parts of your organization, because you have the controlling voice on the board and you can prevent the abuse of, you can more effectively prevent the abuse of decision-making power. So you can afford a higher degree of decentralization. Now, if it's important to coordinate, if you really don't want to offer too high discount for the car just because you give too much decision-making authority to individual dealers, you probably should consider re-centralizing or decentralizing less. Now, the most interesting part here, you can read more about it in the textbook. The most interesting part here, however, is this point about communication. The communication, we mean the information and communication technology, the computer, internet, big data, telephones, etc. Now, the effect of communication on centralization versus decentralization is actually quite ambiguous. You know, on the one hand, better information technology allows a greater degree of control over decision making, right? So now that I can talk with my co-authors and research assistants via Skype, I'm happier to, you know, delegate more tasks to them because I can control what they're doing. I can see when they go to Dropbox, I can see what they do on the Dropbox, and I can call them at any time on Skype and ask them to do certain things. So this progress in information technology allows for a greater degree of decentralization. However, the same progress in technology makes it easier. The same progress in technology makes it easier to control things from the center. Okay? And because it makes it easier to control things from the center, some of these problems, which avoiding which was the advantage of decentralization, are no longer problems, right? Because you can control individual actions, because you can have access to a lot of information, to much more information that you had access before, thanks to the information communication technology, it doesn't cost you a lot of time to make decisions anymore. It costs you less time. You do know a lot more local information now that you can go to Google Map and see exactly how the street looks like, right? You can read reports from different hotels, so you don't need to rely on your local agents to choose the best trip for you, etc., etc. So the effect of information and communication technology on the degree of centralization is ambiguous. So most of the time we are talking about unambiguous effects, but in this case it's a more interesting case because it's not quite clear. Now, in the rest of the lecture, I'd like to talk about the horizontal allocation of decision rights. And the question here is, now forget about centralization, decentralization. Let's freeze it, right? Let's assume that the decision rights have been optimally allocated between the CEO and the local departments. So you are here, you already have the optimal degree of discount that you can give on the car that you're selling. The next question is, should you deal with customers individually, or should you deal with customers as a team? You know, should you, within the authority that is given to you, should you act as an individual, or should you make collective decisions as a team? Now, sometimes teams are better, other times teams are actually worse. So there are advantages and disadvantages of team versus individual decision making. Now, I have never seen a team of car sales agents trying to sell a car to me. It's always one. And there's a reason for it, right? There's a reason for it. I have never seen a single member of the department making a proposal and making the hiring decision for another professor in the department. It's a team, it's a collective decision, right? So some decisions are made in teams. Now, if I want to hire a Hevi for myself, a research assistant, I don't have to initiate this decision and get it ratified by the rest of my department or by the rectorate. So I can really, I can really hire whoever I like for a research assistant position. But if I want to hire someone more senior, I have to get it ratified. So, advantages and disadvantages of decision making in teams. What is the now teams are great, you know. Most of the work today is done in teams. In a lot of management scholars are ecstatic about teams, you know, teams, diversity, collective decision making, fun, great feeling of mission, feeling of belonging, etc., etc. I hate teams. Teams are necessary evil of today's economy. I work in teams. In fact, all my work is in teams. But I realize that teams have not only advantages but also disadvantages. So let's look at them. Now, the clear advantage of teams, that's why teams are such a popular way to do work, especially today, is that teams allow for a very efficient use of individual, fractured, local, incomplete knowledge that different team members have, right? So I do my research in teams. And in these teams, we specialize in tasks. Some people are very good at writing. Other people are very good at statistics. Other people are very good at literature survey. Other people are very good at data acquisition. There are so many tasks in the research process, and we are imperfect human beings. We are not infinitely rational. We don't have the full knowledge, right? We have fragmented knowledge. And when we are in a team, we combine this knowledge together, and based on this enlarged knowledge set, we can make much better decisions. We can produce much better product than if we were trying to do our work independently. So that is really a very cool thing about teams. Even I acknowledge this. Now, another cool thing about teams is a better coordination within the team than across the teams, right? So because team members have more chance to talk to each other, they have more chance to collude with each other when it comes to making important collective decisions than in the case when these individuals were unrelated to each other at all. So avoiding the costs of coordination by bringing decision-making agents into a team together could be a viable strategic option. Now, what are the disadvantages of teams? There are a couple. So one is referred in the literature as agenda setting, and I will show you an example of agenda setting. Agenda setting is basically strategic manipulation by individual team members when it comes to making collective decisions by voting. Because of this strategic manipulation, you can actually lead the team into making a decision which is not good for the team as a whole, but very good for yourself. Now, we will see how it works. It's an interesting mathematical problem. Now, another problem with the team, and that's really, you know, that's really, really what makes teams very controversial, despite their huge advantages, and is the free rider problem. Free rider problem. So later on in your studies, you will be working on term papers and course projects together in teams with some other students. And I'm sure everybody is very conscientious, very intelligent, very friendly, and is willing to pull the weight, etc., etc. But once in a while, you're bound to be in a team with an asshole who is not going to do anything, right? And he doesn't have to, because the grade is shared between you. Now, the free rider problem begins when you bear the costs of your individual contributions towards the team good, but the total output created by the team is divided indiscriminately equally between the team members. So you always rely on the contribution from the other team members, and, you know, take it easy yourself, because anyway you're going to get a share, an equal share of the team output no matter what you do. So that's the free rider problem that we will consider in this lecture as well. Now, agenda setting. Let me give you an example. So here's a decision-making situation. There's a team of Angela, Bruno, and Cindy, the three decision-makers, who have a certain amount of decision-making rights, and they have to make a decision. So there are three options to make a decision. There are three candidates who have applied for the macroeconomics position. There's Alfred, there's Bob, and there's Cyril. Okay? So Angela likes Alfred best. Cyril comes second, Bob comes third. in her ranking. Now, Bruno likes Bob. Second place is Alfred, third place is Cyril. And Cindy is really ecstatic about Cyril, okay about Bob, and really doesn't like Angela or Alfred, whoever it is. Yeah? So let us imagine a voting situation based on these data. So let's just say, well, who is voting for Alfred, who is voting for Cyril, who is voting for Bob? And what you will soon discover is that the voting does not lead to a result. Each person favors another option. Right? There's no clear majority. You know, if you are asked to say, okay, indicate who you prefer the best, and then you collect these pieces and you say that you see that every candidate has exactly the same number of votes, so you can't decide. Well, then somebody's making a suggestion. Suppose it's Angela. Angela is very strategic and she's making suggestions. She said, guys, come on, let's make it easier. Let's do pairwise voting. Let's exclude the options that we really don't like. And you know, the time is ticking. You have to go and give a lecture, and the Berufungskommission is really taking a lot of time. You say, okay, Angela, great. You know, let's do pairwise voting. Who do you want to exclude? And Angela says, oh, good, okay. So let's first decide whether we like Alfred or Bob better. Let's first decide who we like best, Alfred or Bob. And then we will compare whoever we like best, we compare it with Cyril, because Cyril is the third option outside this. Okay? Now, who will vote for Alfred, given the preferences, who will vote for Alfred versus Bob? Well, Angela will vote for Alfred, because Alfred is number one for her. Now, who will Bruno vote for? Well, Bruno, between these two options, Bruno will vote for Bob, right? And who will Cindy vote for? Cindy doesn't like Bob or Alfred. But Cyril is not on the card for Cindy, right? Cindy has to choose Bob because Cindy hates Bob less than she does Alfred, okay? So this is the result of the voting, or this is the result of the pairwise voting between Alfred and Bob. Who wins? Bob wins. Okay, now, if the pairwise decision was to, you know, now to choose between A versus C, then Alfred would win. Now, let's go back to here. We do it in two steps. Alfred loses because two people vote for Bob. Now, we compare Bob with Cyril. Now, who will be better for Angela? The better candidate for Angela will be Cyril. The better candidate for Bruno will be Bob, because Cyril he really doesn't like. What about Cindy? Cyril. So, if we first start with Alfred versus Bob, and then compare the winner with the Cyril, in whose favor is the final outcome? In Cindy's favor. So if Cindy can set the agenda, she will strategically decide to first eliminate Alfred or Bob and then compare the winner with the Cyril. Now, if Bruno has the agenda setting power, Bruno likes Bob. So what is the best way for Bruno? Assuming that he has the agenda setting power, what is the best way for Bruno to get the team to end up choosing Bob, his preferred candidate? What is the best way for Bruno? The best way for Bruno is first to offer to vote between Alfred and Bob, and then, So if Bob is the preferred candidate for Bruno, right, and Bruno has the agenda setting power, the best agenda for Bruno will be agenda 2. First, Alfred versus Cyril, Alfred wins, and then compare Alfred with Bob. In this comparison, Bob wins because the rest of the team like Bob better than they like Alfred. Now, if Angela wants to maximize her own utility, and she has the agenda setting power, what agenda will she offer? She will offer agenda 3. First, she will offer, okay, let's vote between Bruno and Cyril, and then let's vote between the winner of the first contest and Alfred. So all these agendas are equally fair, right? In some ethical sense, right? You don't exclude candidates. However, these pairwise voting results in completely different outcomes depending on how you organize the voting. Now, if there is a committee and there is a Vorsitzende, if there is the leader of the committee, then this leader of the committee can try to be strategic and manipulate with the voting behavior of the committee members by proposing a certain agenda for the committee decision making. And in the collective decision making, the decision making in teams is often prone to this agenda setting. Now, is it problematic? It's not always problematic, right? That's why, it is problematic, but it's not always huge. It's not always a huge problem, right? Where it can be problematic is if there is a huge conflict of interest between the individual preferences of a particular team member and the preferences of the organization as a whole. Then it can be problematic. If it's best for the organization as a whole that, for instance, Alfred wins. If Alfred is, let's say, objectively the best candidate, then if you delegate the decision making, if you delegate the decision to choose Alfred to the team, it's not guaranteed that Alfred will be chosen. It will depend on which agenda will be pursued during the committee meeting. If it's going to be agenda one, which is preferred by Cindy, then Cyril will win, and for the organization it's going to be a loss because the organization wants Alfred. So that's when things become problematic. But if the agenda of the individual team members is broadly consistent with what the organization wants, then it's less of a problem. What is really, really quite problematic, and there are a lot of real-life examples of this situation, is the free riding in teams. Free riding really exists. We've seen it in the, for instance, diner's dilemma from the games theory lecture, as you may remember. It's quite bad, it's inefficient, and it's a waste of opportunities. So let's consider a typical textbook situation that illustrates the problems with free riding. So here's a team of four members, and this team has a certain investment project available to them. So they have an investment project, some financial vehicle or whatever, some business plan. They have to invest in that plan. And this, depending on how much they will invest, the profit from investing will be determined according to this formula. So look here. What are the two components of the profit? First is you have to pay something. You have to pay something from your own budget. And let's say you have 20 euros each, right? So the first is the cost. That's how much less you will have after making the payment towards the investment project for the team. And then the investment project will generate a payoff. And this payoff will be generated in such a way that you will receive 40% of the total contributions that team members make towards this joint business project. Now, is this, from the point of view of team, from the point of view of the team as a whole, is this project worth investing? Is this project really good value for money or not? What do you think? Is it profitable or is it not profitable? For the team as a whole. What's your idea? Yeah, so let's imagine a situation when everybody invests all their money, okay? When everybody invests all their money, then the investment will be 80, yeah? 40% of 80 is what, 32 euros, right? And so if everybody invests 20 euros, everybody will receive 32 euros back, right? So everybody will make a profit of 12 euros. It's good money, right? Yes, no? Good, excellent. So, but what will, in the absence of coordination, what will individual team members optimally decide to do? How much will they invest? Nothing. Why? That's right, but can you explain it in more mathematical terms? That your intuition is correct, but in terms of maths, why would no one invest a single euro in this project individually? Well, look here, it's very easy. Each euro that you invest in the project costs you a negative payment of 1 euro, because that's the money that you're giving away, right? Each euro that you personally invest in this project is giving you how many? 40 cents. Because we're talking about each euro that you individually invest. Now, you are going to get 40 cents back from every euro that you personally invest. Is this good business? No. So you will not invest anything. The catch is that exactly the same way the rest of the team will do exactly the same way. So instead of this project generating you a profit of up to 12 euros per person, this project will generate you zero. You will have 20 euros which you had before, instead of 32 which you could have had, if you could somehow cooperate with the team. This situation is the essence of the free riding problem in teams. It is welfare maximizing. It is the best thing to do for the team as a whole to contribute everything that they have towards the common project. Because if they do so, they will make a profit of 12 euros each. However, when people rely on somebody else to make this contribution, when they only compare their individual benefits with their individual costs of investment, this comparison suggests that they should not invest anything. Another way of thinking about it is to say, okay, so if I invest my money, I'm going to lose 60 cents from every euro that I will individually invest. But if he invests a euro of his money, I'm going to get 40 cents just for nothing. So what's the best thing for me to do? Is to persuade him to invest. So I would say, guys, you know, yeah, we have to invest into this project. Really, it's good business. Let's do that. Now, when it comes to investing, I will invest zero. My imaginable friend will invest 20. He will lose a lot of money. I will gain a lot of money. But of course, my teammates are also very rational, and they're not going to do anything like this. Therefore, instead of generating some welfare improvement, the welfare improvement that this team decision making generate is going to be zero. So this problem happens everywhere, right? You can come up with lots of examples from the world of business as well as from the world of human relations. Illustrating the free rider problem, and it could be an interesting question, could be a good question for the exam to set up a free rider problem or give examples of free rider problems and explain why the examples that you're giving are the examples of a free rider problem. So very, very interesting. Now, let us finish today's lecture by reflecting briefly on the difference between decision management and decision control. And once again, emphasize the importance of separating the decision management powers from the decision control powers. Complete decentralization is not in general optimal. Why is it not in general optimal? Because when you completely decentralize, you give all these decision-making powers to a particular individual or to a group of individuals, and they're going to really abuse their decision-making power. So the best way to go is to decentralize along the following lines, if you want to decentralize at all. So there are components in the decision rights which collectively refer to decision management. These are the initiation, searching for information, and implementation. So decision management powers have to do with coming up and implementing the decision that you want to implement. Now, the rest, namely ratification and monitoring, they are not decision-making powers. They are powers to control the decisions that somebody is managing and implementing. That's why they're called decision control powers. Now, it's very important to avoid incentive problems and to avoid the use of authority to separate these two powers quite strongly. Because What's going to happen if you give the same person decision management and decision control powers? They're going to abuse it. One example that I've already given, and I would like to repeat it so that you fully understand, or you know, better understand. If you give searching for information and ratification powers to the same agency, the same individual, or the same group of people, they will not do what's best for you, they will do what's best for them. And they will be fully within their decision rights to do so. They will ratify whatever convenient for themselves, whatever the decision that is convenient for themselves that they will themselves come up with. And that's obviously not what you as an organization, as a principal, want. Equally, if you give implementation and monitoring powers to the same person, even if the implementation is against the plan, even if the implementation doesn't really work, even if there are problems, they are not going to be communicated to the principal, because who does the communication? The one who does the monitoring, because this is the one who has the information about the actual performance of the decision that has been implemented. And if this performance is not satisfactory, then no communication will be given, or communication about the action, about the result of this decision, will be distorted beyond recognition to the interest of the person who implements this decision. So that's why it's quite important to separate decision management from decision control. Now, we're going to talk more about it, about decision management versus decision control, in 2 weeks' time from now, when we have a lecture about incentives. Until then, all the best and see you next week.